Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
Thank you for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Hoy, joined by Matt Kinnear. It has been too long, Mr. Kinnear.
It's been way too... I don't even remember the last time that we did a podcast together.
Well, in the way that absence makes the heart grow fonder, it was great to see some messages over the weekend asking when we were being a pod back.
Yeah, thanks. Sorry for everyone that it's been so long. Some other kind of major projects here at Inside Lacrosse took a little bit of our attention. And, we're just waiting for spring. It's almost Groundhog Day, so that's kind of...
It is Groundhog Day. We're recording on Tuesday, but we're posting on Wednesday.
Yeah, so once the... What is it, when the groundhog sees a shadow or doesn't see a shadow? It's a sign of spring is coming?
If you ask me to accurately remember that, you don't know me very well.
My entirety of that is from the Bill Murray classic movie.
Are you going to watch it to celebrate?
You know, I might. My wife's a big Bill Murray fan. It's a classic. What About Bob is her favorite movie ever. But we're on Ozark right now. So we're on the fourth season of Ozark. So I don't know if anything's going to take our attention away from that.
Got it. Well, let's dive in. There's so much preseason content to talk about. We're kind of in that hybrid zone between when the season starts. We have one men's Division I varsity game in the books, that being Mercer's 9-4 win over Bellarmine in Georgia on Saturday. And then we've got either 12, 13 games on the docket for this weekend, starting with Duke versus Robert Morris on Friday afternoon, happy hour lacrosse on the ACC network. It's going to be really exciting to get lacrosse on TV back. For those of you asking about the TV schedule, in addition to when you were going to get a podcast, it's not out yet. So you can count on us to release it as soon as it is available. But Matt, a lot to go over. Let's start with the preseason Division I media poll. Obviously, you and I visited a lot of practices. We saw a lot of teams scrimmage in the fall, and we saw Virginia a ton. You went to their practice. We watched them play the U.S. and Canada. You saw them scrimmage. Where was it? It was in Northern Virginia that you saw
them scrimmage. Yeah, I saw them scrimmage against Penn State and Lehigh.
So, not for lack of exposure, the two-time defending national champions are the number one team in the country. Let me frame it this way. If Virginia does not three-peat, why will that be?
Ooh, that's a good question.
It's the only good question because they've got three returning starters at attack. They have to rebuild their midfield a little bit. They've got one of the best faceoff guys in the country. They have monsters all over the field defensively. And yes, they have to replace Alex Roden in goal and Bobby Gavin transferred to Syracuse. But in Matt Nunes, they bring in our top rated goalie in the 2021 class.
The reason I get, well, first of all, I think the better reason is that just there's another team that just kind of takes a gigantic leap. You know, whether it's Maryland with its depth, Duke with so many offensive weapons, Georgetown, which just has that excellent defense that only got better, plus so many offensive pieces, you know. So I think the answer is probably just another one of these teams has their special year, like Virginia has had their special run of years. But if you're looking at something on the Virginia roster, that is the reason why. I think you do have to point to the goal, because although, you know, Matt Nunes is fantastic and I wrote the story about him in our recruiting issue, he doesn't have that big game experience yet. And Alex Rode was a big gamer. He played his best lacrosse in the biggest moments. So that could come at some point, you know, down the line. You know, maybe they don't have that veteran leadership and goal, and it just makes them feel a little less confident. The other point would be, and this is coming from talking to Lars Tiffany after their scrimmages that they had these past few weeks against Lynchburg, and they also had another scrimmage against Penn State. The middle of the field, Virginia is the team that we think of as the ground ball team. You know, this was a Dom Starja principle. They never got out ground ball. They were a team that basically led the country in ground ball so many years. Coach Tiffany said that they kind of got outworked in the middle of the field in stretches of that Penn State game. I think Penn State's a scrappy team, so that's not too surprising. But, you know, when you think of someone like Jared Connors, the LSM, he's not there anymore. Do they have, you know, how do they replace him? And do
well, let
they
me
have
just jump in there to say that I love Ben Ware.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, they have so many. The funny thing about, you talked about the monsters that they have that are on the field. You know, there's four other guys that are on waiting in the wings, you know, whether they're playing pole or whether they're kind of depth guys that are also like 6'4" and above. It's just crazy how many athletes that they get. But do they have that killer instinct in the middle of the field? You know, that's something that we have to see. And that's been kind of a trademark of Virginia lacrosse. And when you combine the ride and the way they are able to get ground balls, those things win games. You know, it's a cliche, ground balls win games, but it's true. And Virginia's been one of the best at it.
It's actually a really good point. Ian Laviano was kind of always considered to be the third attackman. And when you have, whether it was Matt Moore and X could be Peyton Cormier, who it is now, or when you had, at the end of last season, Connor Schellenberger and Matt Moore, then you can understand how the third attackman would fade into the background a little bit. But not when it comes to creating second chance opportunities. And to your point about creating havoc in the middle of the field, a huge part of that started from the amount of pressure that they were able to put on opponents in the clearing game. And it manifests in so many different ways all across the field. So, yeah, Ian Laviano's absence might be a sneaky important factor if, in fact, the Cavaliers don't win the 22 national championship.
And then, you know, another point, and this is a team I think we'll probably end up talking about here, but North Carolina, you know, I saw them scrimmage against Navy and talked to Joe Bresci afterwards. And he made a really interesting point about how excited he is about this team because of the number of young faces and how good they are. They look, the freshmen, the number one rated freshman class, looked awesome in that scrimmage. But what he was so excited about was that this team has so much potential to improve over the course of the season. And if you're Virginia, you know, where is that? This is a team that's been, you know, built for May, so to speak. That's a story I wrote after the Memorial Day win last year. They've been a team that has found ways to take their weaknesses and get better. But how do you kind of have that steady growth over a season when it feels like you're almost a fully realized product here in January and February? You know, what is their kind of upward trajectory, or do they kind of stay the same over the next 4 months here?
So that's a really interesting point relative to Virginia wasn't dominant wire to wire in either of the last two national championship seasons. And I mean, they almost lost to Bryant in the first round of the NCAA tournament last year. Like, the ability to get better and, quote, peak at the right time is really important relative to continuing the momentum toward winning a championship. And that's a good segue into talking about the number two team in the IL preseason media poll, the Maryland Terrapins, who did go wire to wire until falling a goal short in the national championship game. Jared Bernhardt won the Tartan. He went on to win a Division II football championship at Ferris State and probably won the Division II football player of the year had he not battled injuries throughout the season. So from that standpoint, it's probably hard to argue or probably hard to overstate the impact of losing Bernhardt. That being said, is Logan Wojnarowski potentially the most underrated player in college lacrosse since Stephen Rafis last year?
You know, he's sneakily potentially going to break Maryland's, you know, all-time scoring record. That's crazy. I don't think anyone would have guessed that. He's added elements to his game. He's also started every single game in his career. Since he's, you know, been at Maryland, he's started game one, and he's played all of them. That's incredible. He has added something unique every year to his game, was kind of pigeonholed as just the shooter. You know, now he can feed, he can dodge a lot better, he moves a lot better. He's obviously a physical force. And now he's got the number one. So I think that adds, by wearing the number one jersey, that adds the leadership piece to the puzzle. That adds the command and kind of the clear aspect of being the guy. That adds that to him. So there's no confusion over who your number one is there at Maryland. Logan Wojnarowski is pretty incredible. He's a very mild-mannered, kind of quiet guy. So maybe he doesn't have the, you know, gets the same attention as some of those other guys who have gone through the program. But yeah, I think you're right. He's for a guy who's starting the year as a second team All-American, somehow he's underrated.
Dan Kaplan went to the Terrapin scrimmage versus Boston University, and I was surprised that, well, I mean, just to put it most directly, the incoming fifth-year transfers seem to have the size of the role that they do in this team, particularly with Villanova transfer Keegan Kahn starting at attack and Cornell transfer Jonathan Donville being on the first midfield line. Now, I anticipated both of those guys contributing at the end of the year or by the end of the year, but with the combination of the talent that the Terps have on their roster, combined with, you know, giving a little bit of the tie ghost or the runner with respect to just making sure that guys have an opportunity to either win or hold on to their jobs if they've been a part of the program for multiple years, and what we saw out of Maryland's grad transfers last year, I guess my point is that, like, I just thought that it was going to be Daniel Maltz and Eric Molliver as the second and third attackmen. But Khan has inserted himself squarely in that conversation, and it looks like it's going to be between those four guys starting at attack. And then at the midfield, where it was arguably the unit with the most continuity coming back, Anthony DeMeo, Kyle Long, Bubba Fairman, all Americans in their own right. Fairman maybe having plateaued a little bit offensively. Well, that potentially resulted in last year's number one NLL draft pick getting inserted alongside DeMeo, who missed the fall, and Long. And that's your top six offensively for the Terps. But what that also means is that regardless of whoever the fourth attackman, and then with Fairman potentially either being a utility two-way midfielder or finding a role in the second midfield, you've got eight guys that are either really experienced or really good. In the case of Molliver, who got on the field a little bit last year, but doesn't have the same on-field experience as the other seven guys. You are really familiar with Villanova and the Villanova program. What can you say about Keegan Kahn and what you anticipate him contributing to the Terps?
Yeah, so to your point, Kahn and Don, they're just too good to not play significant roles. I think that's the reason why they are doing what they're doing. Kahn is, I've used this before probably on a podcast, so everyone will have to forgive me if they've heard this analogy before. But if you're a hockey fan, a Capitals fan, he's like Nicklas Backstrom. Not in the sense that he's, you know, a huge assist guy, but just his ability to control the tempo of an offense and to basically keep the ball, if that makes any sense. You know, he's a guy who can withstand a ton of pressure, can get a ton of second chances, calm everything down, and then make something happen as soon as everything is calmed down. You know, that's a skill that can be used in any offense in the country. You know, you don't look at him and like, oh my gosh, this guy is going to jump off the page athletically or run me over or do something fantastic. But he's just extremely versatile in the way that he just makes everyone better. When he needed to be the guy for Villanova last year, he certainly was. But I think he has in a way that maybe like Michael Sowers at Duke last year wasn't a guy that you could plug him into an offense to be a complementary piece. Kahn, you can, even though he has the ability to be your number one. You can also have him as a guy who just makes the other guys who are already on the roster a lot better.
At the defensive end of the field, didn't get necessarily as clear of a vision of the hierarchy with Brett Makar. I always get that wrong. I'm sorry. Not playing in that scrimmage against BU. And then the Terps scrimmaged Delaware and Georgetown last Friday. A scrimmage that was originally scheduled for Saturday, but got moved due to the storm. And we didn't have folks at that one, but reports came out that the Terps and Hoyas played each other pretty even. So good opportunity to transition into the number four team in the preseason poll, and then we'll boomerang back around to number three. The Georgetown Hoyas, I was able to attend their practice in the fall. Matt, have you seen them?
I have not seen them this offseason, no.
Okay. So obviously a tremendous amount of excitement coming off of a quarterfinal run. Obviously, that's the high watermark for the program. Disappointing final game against Virginia. A lot of things went wrong, including faceoff guy going down with an injury off the opening faceoff, and then the very bizarre situation where Coach Kevin Warren was hit with a ricocheted ball during warmups in the head that took him down to his knees. For me, the one-sided outcome of that game, I just kind of – Virginia was clearly better, so I'm not trying to argue that there's a scenario in which Georgetown was going to win. But I don't think – I think that a lot of folks think that Georgetown is overrated coming into this year due to a combination of the fact that they don't have multi-year proof of this being their standard and the way in which their season ended last year didn't look like a Final Four team, contending team. So to the extent that I sit on the other end of the spectrum, certainly a lot of it has to be informed by what I saw in the fall. And this is a team that has to replace Jack Caraway, but I'm sorry, did I say Jake?
Jake Caraway. Yeah, that's been a thorn in your side for several years now.
Yeah. So, but beyond that, they've got a lot of guys that contributed in freshmen and sophomores that are now taking on bigger roles this year after putting together All-America campaigns last year. So TJ Haley, the ex-attackman, who I believe had 5 goals and 49 assists last year, he has put on 15, 20 pounds. He got sick before the season started and lost a lot of weight, and he's put that back on and more. And I think that's going to be really instrumental for his ability to turn the corner and score goals, which I think is our staff's consensus opinion about how they're going to replace Caraway's production. Because, yeah, he's a 50-goal guy. He's a great end-of-shot clock guy. You need a goal, backs against the wall. Whose stick do you want the ball in? Caraway's, no doubt about it. They're probably not going to be able to replace his 50 goals with a player on the roster who didn't score 50 goals last year, but is going to score 50 goals this year. My argument is that everybody has to score 10 more goals, including Haley. And if Haley scores 15 goals this year, if he averages 15 goals a game, then the space he's going to replace for, well, certainly Grant Bundy is kind of the other alpha in this offense, but presumably Dylan Watson, who is an incredible shooter that missed a lot of time last year due to injury, then a bunch of midfielders who have experience, like Thompson and McDermott, who are in a position to take the next step, and then potentially my favorite player in all of college lacrosse, which is Dylan Hess, who I think is going to have a two-way impact that is really only reminiscent of Ryan Conrad and potentially a better defender. That's the recipe for Georgetown being a 14.5 goal per game team. And then at the other end of the field, they bring back pretty much everybody. Zach Geddes didn't, who is, you know, in the conversation for one of the best short stick D middies in the country, didn't practice at the practice that I was at, because I believe he was battling some injuries in the fall as well. But you know, they graduate one long pole and they replace him with Will Bowen. They bring back their goalie, who is a first-team All-American, Gibson Smith, who is probably going to be the maestro for this defense, and then a host of poles who got experience last year. So with the exception of the faceoff position, it's hard to identify a real potential source of liability for this team. How excited are you for the Hoyas heading into 2022?
You know, they just feel like they're that team that's on the cusp, you know, and I know we've said that for the past 3 years, but they still have taken those progressive steps forward. And it's just one more step forward, and you're at the biggest stage in the sport. Yeah, that game got away from them, that last game of the year. But, you know, that's happened before where teams have, you know, just gotten crushed in the playoffs. It doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, oh, they're 11 goals away. It just means that they had one, you know, they need to do one game better to get there. So I think everyone knows that, you know, the process that Kevin Warren had to go through to get to this program to where it is. And I think you're kind of seeing all the pieces are coming together in a really big way. I think this is going to be a team that's on a lot of Final Four prediction lists.
Moving on to another team that has been a staple at championship weekend, the Duke Blue Devils heading into 2021 were arguably the most interesting team in college lacrosse. They brought in the number one recruit in Brennan O'Neill, the certainly consensus, if not unanimous, top asset to be added through the transfer portal in Michael Sowers. And they played Denver on a Friday afternoon that was going to be one of the most anticipated games coming back from having the 2020 season canceled. So point being that heading into last year, it felt like Duke was very much above the radar. This year, it kind of feels like they're a little bit below the radar. Maybe some of that is attributable to the fact that they had a similarly one-sided end to their season as Georgetown did last year. Sean Lilly doesn't have the same profile that Michael Sowers did as an incoming grad transfer. Brennan O'Neill, the number one recruit, the combination of John Grant Jr. and Anthony Kelly or whatever amalgam you want to apply to him, Zion Williamson, we've seen him play at a college level. And now the question is, what's his ceiling? Those are less compelling questions. They're not the number one team. I had the sense that that would be just fine with John Donowski, or even better, preferable. So I asked him, and it was funny because he couldn't really even accept the premise. He was just like, we never get any attention. So for us who live in the national lacrosse landscape, ecosystem, whatever, it felt like Duke was very picked at and exposed and covered last season. Well, apparently it didn't feel like that too much, at least if you were within the program. All that being said, at the other end of the field, they're similar to Virginia and Georgetown in terms of the volume that they bring back. So with the exception of the fact that Jake Naso is one of the best faceoff guys in the country, and that removes that area of concern from who the Blue Devils are going to be. I mean, they're really good.
They're really good. And there's something people kind of look at last year almost like a failure for Duke.
It was crazy. They did not lose in February or March. Maybe that's why.
Which, I mean, Duke, that's weird to begin with. And then not losing in February or March. But so they lost to Notre Dame and North Carolina, two teams that I think everyone had in that championship weekend kind of picture last year. Then the game against Maryland was disappointing, but just the way that I talked about with Georgetown versus Virginia, sometimes that just last game, it slips away from you and then it just kind of all goes downhill from there. And then Coach Donowski's comments after the game, I think, kind of fueled a little bit of this, things weren't working, Duke wasn't Duke kind of narrative. And I don't think he meant it to be that way. I think he was just being honest about the performance of the team in that game. But yeah,
it was also kind of like a referendum or a comment on the transfer portal.
Right. Yeah. So
which I think was like, I don't know, like almost like a convenient thing for folks who think the transfer portal is bad to kind of rely on.
You could make Duke a scapegoat for why, particularly when you looked at Maryland, Virginia last year as two teams that were not as active. They still had between the two of them, four or so transfers on the rosters. But in that context, you could use Duke as the other side of the coin and, hey, this didn't work, but it did work for these teams that kind of stuck to their guys. But yeah, Duke was the number one team in the country for, 13 of the weeks that we did the media poll. They had the bad showing in championship weekend against Maryland, and then only two losses there. But, maybe it didn't always feel like they had their true identity with the way that they were kind of balancing the Sowers and O'Neill, dynamic there in terms of, who was the guy. But maybe we make too much of that anyway. And, it's a long season and, multiple people kind of have to have their time in the spotlight. So I just think it's peculiar how Duke maybe has swung so far from being the super team, being the number one team all year, to, oh my gosh, that year just did not work out. And, what was Duke thinking? Duke's going to be good. They're probably going to be, if we know Duke, they're going to be in the quarterfinals. They probably will be a championship weekend. Duke is Duke. They have so many pieces. You saw them in practice. And, the number of offensive pieces is staggering. Kind of like last year. It's just, how do they balance it out? And how do they get everyone on the field and find that combo in May?
Moving along, the number 5 and 6 teams are in the media poll are Notre Dame and North Carolina. But for me, the number 5 team was Yale. And then also included in the top 10, I had Cornell and Penn. And then in the top 20, I had Princeton. Now, the media at large did not feel the same way. They had Yale at 7, Penn at 11, Cornell at 15, Princeton in the receiving votes category. Matt, how did you feel about the Ivy League in terms of the amount of respect and recognition they get heading into this 2022 season, having not played a Ivy League game and really a game of consequence since spring of 2019?
You know, I think the Ivy League is certainly going to be better than people gave them credit for. I understand the you have to prove it mentality that voters could have. In the sense that, you know, there's these all these teams that did well last year. I'm going to favor them over the team that has not played for 2 years. So I understand it. But, yeah, I'm like you in the sense that, you know, I had Yale at 6. I had Penn at number 8. Didn't have Cornell as high. I had Cornell at 16 and did not have Princeton in my top 20, though I have talked before about how I do think Princeton has potential to be, you know, a to me, they have a few more question marks than the other team, and I am kind of giving the benefit of the doubt to teams like Bryant and Bryant and Drexel there kind of at the back end of the top 20. But yeah, there's no doubt that, you know, nothing has slipped up for, you know, everyone said that recruits weren't going to go to the Ivy League schools. Look at, you know, what they did in the class of 2022, 2020, you know, and 2023 coming up here. Like, the recruits are still flocking to these schools because they offer the best combination of athletics and academics in the country. That's not going to change. In the same way that, like, the guys who are still in the roster, these were very talented players. Yeah, there might be some rust. Maybe that first game isn't going to be the best showing. But over the course of the year, these teams are all going to be, you know, in – some of them are going to be in the top 5. A few of them are going to be in the top 10. And there's going to be multiple Ivy League teams in the top 20. You should definitely bet on the Ivy League if there's money on it this year.
So I'm going to start with Yale because they're the team that I think is going to be the best. I went to one of their practices, so they're the team that I know the best. And yeah, they have to replace Jackson Morrill and Matt Gaudette at the attack. Matt Brandau is back. I think he has the ability to be a Jackson Morrill, if not Ben Reeves, type player and contributor. I think in Will Cabrera, they've got a bona fide goal scorer who's going to take up a lot of the mantle that Gaudette carried. And then in the same way that Morrill emerged as a freshman and Brandau emerged as a freshman, I don't know if Leo Johnson is going to get an opportunity right out of the gate, but the Under Armour All-American is going to get himself on the field in some way or another. And even if he does or doesn't start to start the year, there's like 10 offensive players that are going to be vying for that third attack spot, some of whom have experience, some of whom are essentially freshmen, if not actually freshmen. The midfield, basically the entire second midfield, returns intact. I expect it to be, and they'll return as the first midfielder. I'm sorry, first midfield. So Christian Kropp, Thomas Bragg, and then who that other guy is a little bit up in the air. It was Lucas Kotler. Oh, I'm sorry. No, it's not. It's Brian Tevlin. It's in the second line. I think Logan Solberg is the type of guy who's poised for a huge breakout. So offensively, their top 6 is going to be dialed. They have depth to be able to withstand injuries. They just have to get game reps. The faceoff X is going to be really interesting. Joe Newman is the guy who you would think it's his time, but there are 3 guys on this roster that are pushing him and trying to take some of those faceoff reps. They need to develop depth at the short stick midfielder position, but their top 2 in Jack Okun and Luke Eschbach are experienced and good. And so that shouldn't be an area of concern. Coach Andy Shea is over the moon about Jack Stuzan at long stick midi. He was our number 6 recruit in the 2020 class. I believe he might've been number 7. And he thinks he's going to be the best LSM in the country. They've got a little bit of depth there too, including Jay Cohen, who was a 2021 Under Armour All-American. Charlie Weitzel, who's 6'5", and kind of flipped the switch heading back into this season. And then down low, Chris Fake was in the conversation for the Smusher Award as a freshman. Mikey Alexander, a U21 team defenseman, is better than him on some days. And then in Bryce DeMuth, they have kind of a bona fide third defenseman. They do have additional depth at that position. And then they've got a battle in goal. Brody Wilson took Jack Starr's starting position in 2020, Starr's junior year. He decided to come back, and he's getting pushed by Jared Paquette, another U21 team member. So there aren't a lot of holes on this Bulldog team. And I think that that's one of the reasons that, in general, the media is higher on the Yale than they are on the other two or three Ivy League teams where, you know, Penn, again, don't want to sell them short shrift because they've got talent over the field, but they also might have the best player in the country in Sam Hanley. And then with Cornell, who having to replace Jeff Teat, and Princeton having to replace Michael Sowers, I think there's a lot of concern or questions about what they're going to look like, specifically with respect to what Cornell's going to look like without Teat. CJ Kirst is really good. So I think John Piattelli is going to provide the veteran leadership and goal scoring. And then Michael Long and CJ Kirst, who play together at Del Barton, are going to grow into the role of changing the look of this offense a little bit, but certainly bringing a lot to the table from a point production standpoint.
Terry, to your point about Yale being the team that, you know, the media is highest on, and, you know, I'd say both of us had them ranked the highest among the Ivy League teams. It's culture, you know, and this isn't to take away the culture of anyone else. It's just to say that, you know, if there's any team, any program that could somehow turn this whole weird 2-year gap of not playing games into a positive, it's Yale and Coach Andy Shea, because they've just done things differently, you know, over the past decade that's led to kind of their, you know, rise to being the premier team in the country for that, you know, series when they won the national championship. So I think that there's, well,
just to put a more specific point on that. So Andy has this mad scientist, exercise science, athletic development specialist that has been a part of the program for 7-8 years. And I don't think that their methods are revolutionary, but I do think that they are different from a lot of other programs in terms of the way they emphasize the development of muscle mass at the expense of cardiovascular activity. And one of the things that this guy used to always say to Andy is the worst thing for getting these guys into the athletic specimens that would win you 5 national championships in a row is actually playing lacrosse. So the point being that not having to play lacrosse games for effectively 2 years is kind of giving this guy exactly what he's been asking for the preceding 6 or 7 years. So to your point about it being a perverse positive silver lining, like, yeah, you're absolutely right. I think that, you know, what I saw in the fall was illustrative of exactly how much bigger these guys have gotten, how much more muscle mass they've added.
The other team, I just want to mention a little bit more with Penn. You know, I'm really high on Penn. I had them at number 8 in my voting, you know, and they finished outside the top 10. They finished at number 11 in the media poll voting. And I kind of actually thought of Penn at 7 too, but I put Loyola there instead. But I really like them. Obviously, Sam Hanley, who you mentioned, is arguably the best player in the country. I think he will, at the very least, be the best pro in kind of this group. And, you know, his future is still to be determined. You know, I know that they have some options for him to come back if he chooses to Penn, but he could also have the option to play a year at Penn and play a year somewhere else or play 2 years somewhere else. You know, obviously, there's a lot of figuring out to do, and now's not necessarily the time for that, you know, for anyone that's just starting their college lacrosse season. But Patrick Birkinshaw really, really stood out at practice. And I think he's going to be a difference maker for them in net. And then the guy that might be the breakthrough player this year is going to be attackman Jack Schultz. Keep an eye on him. I saw him and I talked to Coach Murphy about him. I didn't realize that he's not, you know, he kind of was a lefty sharpshooter when I was there. He just kept hitting the corner just left and right. Just, it was impressive. And then, you know, I was talking to Coach Murphy and he's like, yeah, he's not even a lefty. That just kind of was the day that he was having. So he can do so many things. I think he's going to be a big guy. You know, he is big. He's like 6'3". But he's going to be a big guy going forward. I think there's a lot more talent on that team, and the defense is a lot better than, you know, the last time we kind of saw them in earnest. So really watch out for Penn to be a really special team this year.
As we bring this podcast in for a close and tease that you're going to have to check back next week, I'm sorry, later this week, for a conversation about the preseason media All-Americans. Matt, we got to talk about one team that I did not have in my preseason media poll. And that is the Syracuse Orange. And since casting that vote, we found out that Owen Hilt sustained an upper body injury that is potentially going to keep him out for extended time, depending on how the season unfolds. I think that could potentially be a season-ending injury. I have a lot to say about the rationale behind my vote. So the first is their schedule is brutal. The second is, while I think the change in coaching staff is likely to have multi-year positive outcomes, I do think that there is going to be some pain in the short term. And I think that you've kind of seen it from the standpoint of how effective this staff has been in recruiting the class of 2023. Now, granted, Dusko and his staff did a really nice job on the 22s. So, you know, maybe it was momentum that was already started anyhow. But the stylistic differences between John Dusko and Leland Rogers versus Gary Gate and Dave Petromala, I would compare to the stylistic differences between Dave Petromala and Peter Milliman with Johns Hopkins between 2020 and 21. And I do think that that lack of continuity between staff and players cost Hopkins in the early part of the season. And even though Syracuse hasn't necessarily had the same setbacks that Hopkins did, they were able to practice in the fall, et cetera, I do think that there was always going to be a similar transition. And when you combine that with the early schedule that includes Maryland, Virginia, and Army, it was just a really daunting hill to climb. And now when you take away the guy who I, and I think many others think is their best offensive player, it just makes the challenge even steeper.
I mean, Hiltz is a huge loss. There's no doubt about it that, you know, one of the just most dynamic young players in the country. But I mean, I got to say, like, how cool is it that a program cares that much?
That's the best thing about it. You're absolutely right. They're like, they're football fans.
Yeah. Like there's, and you know,
and what he's referring to is the fact that I got roasted online for not having them in my top 20.
Yeah, and people, you know, people accused you of, you know, just doing it for clicks or whatever. That doesn't, like, first of all, that doesn't do anything for us as, like,
Twitter clicks do not equal revenue for Inside Lacrosse.
Right. But I mean, it's awesome, and you know, this is coming from someone who grew up in Baltimore, went to Maryland. Like, nobody cares about lacrosse like they do. And I'm kind of going to draw the ire of the Long Island crowd here, but just like the upstate New York crowd, the central New York crowd, nobody cares about lacrosse like they do. And it's really cool to see the Syracuse fans really come out, come after you and just really care. You know, lacrosse needs that. And hey, would it be surprising if it would be surprising, but would it be out of the question if they're a lot better than you think and that the media as a whole thinks? And you know, maybe they beat Virginia early. Maybe they go on a run and maybe they make the Final Four. Hey, that can, they're Syracuse. They can do that. There's a lot of talent on that roster. But right now, when you look at, you know, all the teams ahead of them that are a little more firm for all the reasons that you said, but, you know, just in terms of guys coming back, continuity, just least question marks, not having their star player out, you know, it makes sense that they're going to kind of be there a little, not under the radar, because like we just said, everyone cares about Syracuse more than everyone else, but they're not going to be thought of as the most threatening team in the country to start the year, which is weird for Syracuse. You know, it's a program that's used to kind of starting from the top or being in the mix there of the scariest teams in the country. It's the scariest place to play. The Orange is kind of like, you know, you look at the Orange and you're like, oh my God, I'm playing against Syracuse. Maybe that's not the case this year, but they can definitely surprise everyone.
Well, Matt, that'll do it for this edition of the Inside Lacrosse podcast. Like I said at the top, we're still transitioning from preseason to early season, so we're going to come back later in the week with one more preseason concept, and then we'll be back next week as we start to transition into in-season mode.
Love it. Let's bring on the season. I can't wait for Duke Vermont this week. That's going to be the game that I'm definitely circling, but I just can't wait for games in general. I can't wait for my Tuesday night to be, you know, watching lacrosse. I can't wait for Wednesday, Thursday to kind of be watching those D3 games. You know, I can't wait for the big Sunday women's games and the Friday night women's games, Big Ten Sunday night, ACC Thursday night. It's all awesome.
Insert Bart Scott can't wait dot gif here.
Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.